Welcome to Women on Air, a weekly show about women, feminism, and social justice, brought to you by CFUV's Women's Radio Collective.
Great show for you. Coming up first, I have an interview with Sally Ross, who is helping to coordinate the Creatively United for the Planet Festival that is coming up this weekend, Friday, April 25th, and Saturday, April 26th. So we're going to just jump right in because it's a really jam-packed interview. So stay tuned. All right, so I'm talking with Sally Ross, who is the project manager for Creatively United for the Planet. Hi, Sally.
Hi, Jen.
Hi, it's great to have you here in the studio with me.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be invited.
So first off, can you tell me a little bit about what Creatively United for the Planet is all about?
Sure. We're a not-for-profit society, and our mandate is environmental protection through community connection. And we do that in a number of ways in the community through some annual events, and one of the main ones is the Creatively United for the Planet Festival. We're in our third annual year, and it's happening at St. Anne's Academy, and it's going to be an amazing opportunity to meet people from all walks of life in our community and share many, many experiences around what it means to be living here and celebrating where we eat, work, live, play, and study.
What is the goal of the festival?
Basically, we are showcasing and celebrating what people are doing around health, the environment, business. Basically, we cover a whole bunch of different sectors of the community. We bring people together through music, art, and dance. There's going to be music all day on the grounds. The festival is free outdoors on Saturday the 26th. And then we have a bunch of indoor events that are helping us fundraise so that we can make it a free all ages family event. So there's going to be about 100 exhibitors. It's going to be, so the grounds are going to be very active and very busy. It's going to be a sunny day. And music and inside we'll have various educational events that will be of interest actually to a lot of people, in especially at UVic, I think, because we're covering different topic areas that students would be really interested in.
So why don't you tell me about some of those events that you were just talking
sure.
about?
Sure. So Friday night, we have two events happening inside St. Anne's Academy. The first is an unusually creative conversation, and it's with Elizabeth May, Green Party leader. And we also have in that conversation Jed Goldberg, who is the 20-year president of Earth Day Canada. So he's been involved in the environmental movement for a very, very long time. But then thrown in the mix also is probably one of the most well-known collage artists internationally. His name is Nick Bantock. I'm not sure if students necessarily will be aware of his work, but many will. He wrote the Griffin and Sabine books. He's an artist and author, and has worked internationally offering people new ways of thinking about creativity and how to go deeper into yourself and engage your creativity. So he's, it's just going to be a really, really neat discussion. And that will be facilitated by someone from CTV. So that's going to be a fun event. And then next door at the auditorium will be Iconic Songs That Changed the World. And that is 9 local artists, including Daniel Lapp and Katrina Kadoski, and a bunch of others that are on the local music scene. And we'll be covering tunes from Leonard Cohen and Bob Marley and Bob Dylan, Joni Mitchell. And so there's going to be, that's going to be a really beautiful concert and probably a lot of sing-along tunes as well. So
yeah, sounds like it's going to be great. You said earlier that there are several different sectors that you're focusing on. So
yes.
I noticed on your website that you talked about business and community and arts.
Yep.
Can you tell me a little about each one of those, why they're important?
So outdoors, there will be, as I say, 100 exhibitors. A lot of them are nonprofits, and then a lot of them are artists. A lot of people that are doing work around environmental issues and social justice issues and health issues. So, but just to be more specific around some of the offerings in the educational events during the day on Saturday, there's going to be a talk called When Health and Business Tie the Knot, and it's looking at fair trade and organic businesses. We've got Stacy Toews, who's the co-founder of Level Ground Trading, and if anybody knows about Level Ground Coffee, it's a very, very incredibly wonderful business. Stacy and his team, they work with 5,000 farmers in 10 different countries, and every aspect of the business cycle is just about ethics and compassion and paying farmers a fair wage for their work and growing organically, and a lot of the profits are reinvested back in the communities. So a couple of us at Creatively United have seen this talk and have been very profoundly moved. He's going to be joined by Dion Laszlo Baker, who has a business called DB's Organic Tea Pops. And that is, these are popsicles made of organic teas and natural sweeteners. And this woman also, she has a background in, I believe it's neonatology. So she started out as an academic looking at toxins in food and health and the development of new babies. And so we're looking at business from a very broad perspective around ethics and health and social enterprise and that kind of thing. So that's a really, I mean, for people that are interested in business, they're going to get some amazing ideas from these two presenters that will be held in the auditorium. So it's about a 10 by 10 foot screen for their slides, which will bring a lot of sort of animation to what they're talking about. Also, on a business or economic slant, we've got another talk happening in that same auditorium called Empowered Money Making Change. And we've actually got our MP, Murray Rankin, will be speaking at that. Lisa Helps, who is the executive director of community microlending. And she is also one of our city councillors and is running for mayor. Donna Morton, who is very well known for working in what's called impact investing, looking at how to develop investment portfolios that are life enhancing and life supporting and life cultivating rather than life destroying. And yeah, Donna's fantastic. She's given probably about 5 TED Talks. She used to work in renewable energy. So, and there's one other person I'm missing there. Oh yes, Ian McKenzie, who is a local filmmaker. Well, he's local now because he just moved from Vancouver to Victoria. But he produced with Velcro Ripper, Occupy Love, which is a very well-known documentary, as well as a short film called Sacred Economics. And that's featuring the writing and the work of someone named Charles Eisenstein. And so this particular session will be talking about economics in terms of where we're going in our world in terms of our money, how we move money, how we create money, how we think about money, and how money shapes how we behave. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be of interest, I think, especially to a lot of people in economics, because we're going to be talking about things that don't necessarily come up in economics classes, but they are more and more because they have to. You know, mm-hmm. we're in a world that is on the brink of collapse on many levels in our ecosystems and in our social systems, and we have to rethink how we're doing things. And so our organization is about fostering the relationships whereby those kinds of collaborations where we do move in that direction actually happens mm-hmm. on the ground. Mm-hmm. Let's see. You asked about
The arts.
The art one. Okay, the arts. Yeah. So one of our talks is also with artist Robert Bateman, and Creatively United for the Planet is we have a working collaboration with the Robert Bateman Center and the Bateman Foundation, and Robert has been actually a great supporter of the festival for all 3 years that it's been running. He is going to be, his talk is called The Heart of the Matter, and he is as an avid lover of nature and an avid proponent of children getting engaged in nature and getting involved in learning about the natural world. That talk is going to sort of bring in how art can foster that relationship, which we so, like our whole being demands that relationship, right? And when we're out of touch with it, we are, you know, out of touch with ourselves. And so that's going to be a beautiful sharing as well there. We have, let's see, I'm just moving down the list of all the events we've got going on. Another educational event is called No Health Without Soil Health, The Elephant on Your Plate. Mm-hmm. And this is a talk with basically a group. There's three different people who are, they're sort of like permaculturists. They're doing intensive organic farming. And the person who's facilitating that, she has a business called Cultivating Soil Solutions. And she's going to be talking about how the word organic is so prolifically used, and yet it doesn't necessarily indicate how nutrient dense our foods are and how healthy our soils are mm-hmm. to bring those nutrient dense foods to our tables. Mm-hmm. And so she's actually got the ability to test. There's something, it's called a Brix meter. I think it's, some people may know what it is, but it actually tests the nutrient density of foods. Like you can actually just have a vegetable in your hand and you can put a drop, I think you mix it with some liquid like a juice or something or water, and it actually shows you like how dense your food is. And you can compare, you know, at different times of year, or you can compare like a locally grown, so non-organic product or item of food versus an organic item from like an organic farm in California or something. And you kind of, you'll get to be able to see what is it actually I'm putting in my body. You know, what they're telling me on the label doesn't necessarily reflect the health, the true health of what the food is. So, and there will be lots of people on site at their exhibits talking about these kinds of issues as well. Mm-hmm. On Saturday night, there's going to be a screening of a film called The Clean Bin Project. Okay. And it's it was the year-long endeavor of a couple in Vancouver who decided they were going to swear off consumerism for an entire year and not produce any waste whatsoever. I think I haven't seen the film myself, but I understand they even avoided things that could be recycled, like they didn't want anything going into any waste stream mm-hmm. at all. So they went about to form their and shape their lives on making themselves the most empowered consumers they could possibly be around, being able to live lives without producing waste. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be screened in conjunction with the Capital Regional District, where we're going to be getting some support from those guys to have a little discussion afterwards, where we talk about, you know, how can we move in this direction? How can mm-hmm. we keep going towards a more and more conservationist approach, and how do we get away from being a wasteful, you know, throwaway society, mm-hmm. which is on many levels where we're still at.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think now's a good time to point out that you guys are actually part of an NGO. The Creatively United is part of a larger NGO.
Yes,
can you tell
me
about that?
Yes. So our mandate is environmental protection through community connection. Mm-hmm. And there's some, basically we're all volunteers. So even the founder of the organization, her name is Frances Littman. She's an incredible visionary, and she formed this organization a number of years ago, and it started with the first annual Creatively United for the Planet Festival. It drew 2,500 people the first year, and last year there were 5,000. So this year, I mean, I don't think she could have imagined the success that she was going to have. But there are some ongoing programs throughout the year as well. One of the things is we're doing our best to get into schools to work with kids more and more around creating awareness around the ecosystems that surround them and support them to be in touch with their local region. So there's actually an ongoing program with Rock Heights Middle School in Esquimalt. And it's actually pretty exciting because these kids, a group of kids from the Songhees First Nation that are part of that school are going to be bringing, they're creating a song and doing some drumming for our opening ceremonies for the festival. So that's the organization calls it like our ABC approach. So that's the arts-based approach. That's the A. But there's actually now, as a result of our Creatively United's collaboration with that school, they've now got a green team at the school, and they're doing recycling throughout the school. And they were apparently the last school in the district to have recycling. So it's great that the kids are really getting that education in the value of that and the importance of it. And they're also learning about the Gary Oak ecosystems that are nearby. They've been able to go and learn more about the ecosystem itself. So that's part of so Frances and a couple of other people on the team are working with the principal of that school and a couple of the teachers to get those kids involved. Yeah, and actually you just twigged the thought around another event that's happening at the festival, which is Environmental Education, Creating a Better Tomorrow Today. And this is actually a panel that's being put together by a group of education leaders who are really concerned. Well, I guess the government has made these proposed changes to the BC curriculum from K to 12, grade 12.
The oil industry ones in Alberta.
I'm not sure, you might have heard about this, but yes, definitely what's trying to be pushed through is less emphasis on environmental education and more emphasis on mining, on LNG, you know, liquid natural gas, on, you know, so basically these teachers and these environments or these education leaders are coming together to say, you know, we need, through our connections with each other, where we know this is not okay, we know that this is like a huge backwards step for how we teach our children, that these kinds of connections that will be fostered at the festival will then have like concrete actions towards, you know, like they're going to hopefully create a collaborative response and a coordinated response to the government because they've asked for it, right? And there has to be a whole swath of people who go back and say, you cannot do this. We have to go in a completely opposite direction than what you're proposing. So
I think it's hard though. I worry a lot. I do a lot of interviews that are left leaning, obviously. And I feel that sometimes we demonize oil companies, but I feel there's a reason that they've turned into energy companies, because if their mandate is to be making a profit, which right now oil is doing, eventually they're going to have to move into an area that is no longer oil producing. They have to be investing in new energy. So I always am very wary about demonizing oil companies, because they also, they're a double-edged sword, because they offer the potential and the monetary investment in new energy.
Absolutely.
So I think it's interesting. I agree that we should be looking at that now rather than when the oil runs out. It should be something that is a mandate that we should be moving towards today. But I think that that's perspective is important, in that there's more to it. It becomes increasingly complicated more community groups that are involved, I feel.
Yeah, it does. And I think, but the opportunity there is, and as you're saying, that everybody can be involved in the conversation. Like there's no reason to exclude the oil companies from the conversation, because you're absolutely right. They have a role, they have a huge role to play. They have a huge responsibility to continually innovate in how they do business, and continual innovation is going to be looking like doing business in a completely different way than it's been done in the past. And so so I think that you're absolutely right. There's the demonization approach has got to stop as well, because that way it creates wars, you know, it creates and it creates fractioned possibility for conversation and forward-moving collaborations, which is the only way things can go. And the oil companies are here. They're a reality, right? So they're part of the conversation too. Our ABC approach. And then the B is working with businesses. So there's another side project of Francis's is having it's called the Vancouver Island Green Scene. It's a values-based business network. And we have, I'm not sure how many members we have, maybe 20 or 25 members at this point, but it's just basically a way to bring businesses together who are working from a values-based perspective around ecological and social priorities. And so there's a monthly meeting. It's basically a networking meeting at this point. And I think there's sort of more ideas in development for how to increase the visibility and the impact of that community in Victoria. So that's the business aspect. And then we also, the community aspect is the festival. That's our biggest project. We're actually kind of excited about the fact that we've just recently developed a relationship with Vancity Credit Union, and we're looking to do some more events with them in the coming year and 2 years and 3 years. We're looking at a 3-year timeline, actually. So they're going to be supporting us in doing some joint projects. Yeah, so the main thing with the festival is that it's sort of a big bang. Like, there's so much that happens over the course of a very short period of time, and there's such an incredible opportunity to create new innovative collaborations and to meet people in our community, to bring out the kids, bring out the youth, bring out, you know, everybody who wants to just meet people and share and learn about what people are doing. And do it in a celebratory way. And then out of that, out of this event, which does include so many nonprofits, we have a lot of really supportive sponsors, a lot of sponsorship in kind. We're needing to raise funds for the event through our educational sessions. And we also have a silent auction. So we've had a lot of donations to our silent auction, which is great. So if people are, well, people will come and get to see what a beautiful silent auction we put together. And that's another way of us doing a bit of fundraising to cover the cost of the festival. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I mean, the sponsors are many, and it's hard to list them all, but, and our supporters on many levels, but mm-hmm. Mainly it's exciting that this is an event that's really powered by generosity. It's, mm-hmm.
And you're actually a volunteer. You're not.
Yes.
This is not a paid job for you. This is a volunteer.
Yes. Yes.
So obviously this is running off of a lot of passion for you.
Yeah.
How did you become involved?
I've known Frances for a few years, mm-hmm. and for the last 2 years, I have played in a percussion band, local percussion band, quite well known, called Masala, and we do African, Cuban, Brazilian type rhythms, and we play at community marches and outdoor community events mainly. And so we played at the festival the last 2 years, and I'm not formally in the band. I'm still involved in the band, but not such an intensive involvement. But I was excited to be able to invite the band back this year, and. What happens is Earthwalk, which leaves Centennial Square at 12 o'clock on, actually, I think it leaves around 12:30. People gather at 12, around 12:30, the walk is leaving Centennial Square, marches through downtown Victoria, and the festival is the ending point for the march, for the walk. So Masala will be part of that, and they'll be bringing, you know, there's going to be lots of music and lots of sort of, you know, people bringing their passion and their commitment for our community and our participation in everything that has to do with loving the earth and supporting the healing of the earth. And that will end up at the festival, and then we'll have some opening ceremonies, and we will begin a very big day. Just stepping back to your question about my connection with Frances, I had an opportunity to also be involved in an event in the fall called Living the New Economy, and it was a week-long summit or convergence of people that are really focused on looking at how we create local and regional economic development from the ground up, and using very creative models of doing business and looking at local food systems and climate change. And so these were, and Indigenous involvement in all of these issues as well, which is a really important aspect as well. So yeah, that event covered a whole range of topic areas as well. But Frances and the Creatively United for the team was involved in that event, and so it was sort of after that that Frances approached me and was excited to possibly work with me on the festival. And I've kind of jumped in with 2 feet quite quickly. I have a background in community planning, so this is really right up my alley in terms of being part of a community celebration, being part of coordinating and organizing and bringing people together to make this happen, and thinking about community from a very broad perspective, because I think just going back to the idea of this being an event that is a collective conversation amongst many sectors and with many people, that we, through these conversations, we really are shaping our community. We really are thinking about, you know, Victoria being a model and an example for the whole world. I mean, we are really so privileged here because of the natural beauty and because of the social capital that we have in Victoria. And also we're privileged in the fact that we can have conversations with our politicians, you know, like at many levels, we are able to be part of a much bigger conversation about who we are and where we're going and what kinds of big changes we need to make so that we have a world to live in. So it's a really special time.
Right.
Yeah.
So what do you hope people who attend the festival will walk away with, and how do you think that will create political change?
That's a very good question. So what people walk away with is, of course, a mystery. because of the fact that we have so many things happening in one location, amongst many, many groups of people. And there are a couple of UVic groups involved as well, I should mention. There's a group called the Echo Car, and they're going to be showing us how to refurbish vehicles to be more ecologically friendly. So, and then the other, sorry, I think I'm diverging from your question, but I just thought I should throw in the UVic contribution. Creatively United has also been working with a group in a political ecology class. And this group is actually producing, it's a sort of a joint collaboration with the City of Victoria and Creatively United to produce some very accessible materials around something called the Community Energy Emissions Plan, which is one of Victoria's policy areas around reducing emissions in Victoria. So they have sort of a long-term plan for different strategies for doing that. And so we get to work with a team of UVic students, which is really fantastic. And then they get to bring that to the festival and work with to work with the City of Victoria on getting that information out. So it's really great, you know, that we're connecting. We're really community connectors. We're connecting people in the political world with, you know, at the municipal level and with the nonprofits and with businesses and social enterprises and students and school teachers and kids. And so, yeah, in terms of what people will get out of it, I mean, I hope that people are come to celebrate. I think there's really two things. Celebrating who we are and all of the diversity of contributions that people are making in our community. So there's the celebratory nature of it, and then there's also the I would call it inquiry. Like there's really we have a very important emphasis on the educational inquiry aspect around all the different sectors, and how can we align ourselves ever more closely with how the natural world actually functions. And how can we regenerate how we think about things? How can we regenerate how we do collaborative organizing for social and environmental change? These are the kinds of questions that I think, you know, they're being asked around the world. And if you don't ask them at the local level with your friends and neighbors and colleagues, then you're not really asking them, right? So it's really... Yeah, I think that's, to me, like where I'm coming from in my practice as a community planner, and also thinking about and being passionate about all the issues that are sort of converging within mm-hmm. one place at the festival. I think this aspect of inquiry cannot be overstated. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, and everybody has a role to play. Everybody has, everybody can participate, and everybody can find out. Come to the festival with the open mind. You just will have the ability to realize how empowered you can be to work with people on change, mm-hmm. issues of change.
Just something that interesting that you brought up is kind of the loss of connection between people and the land. And I think part of that comes from this idea that thinking people are separate from nature.
Exactly,
and,
yes.
And I feel like part of the celebratory aspect yes. that you're talking about is mm-hmm. finding that reconnection
yes.
with the natural environment and recognizing yeah. that humans are a part of that.
Exactly. You just hit the nail on the head, Jen, because right. I think in so many of the discussions that are going to be had, it's like, you know, on some level, everybody is saying the same thing. Like when you're aware and you feel connected to yourself and to your community and to your neighbors and your family and the work that you're doing, it's like fundamentally we know that things became awry in human evolution because of this belief that we are separate from each other and nature, mm-hmm. the belief that we're not nature. Which is just ludicrous. You know, it's like here's two bodies sitting here having a conversation, and we're life itself. You know, we are life. We are an expression of life. It's a magical, phenomenal, unbelievable thing. The mind cannot comprehend the magic of it, right? Mm-hmm. But then as we engage with each other and as we engage with life and as life, we gain this ever bigger perspective on the fact that we are inseparable from everything. Like everything in the planet is who we are, mm-hmm. right? And so for us to constantly be moving more and more towards life regenerative ways of behaving is really, I think, why why Creatively United exists, because in terms of social human evolution, if we're not creatively united now, we don't have a hope, right? Like that's kind of where, that's where we're at. Like everybody's coming to terms with the fact that this misunderstanding, this misidentification that has developed in the human individual and collective thinking process about who we are is causing the destruction of everything that we depend upon to be healthy and safe and happy, and all the other beings that we share this planet with as well.
I think, well, I was thinking that, like, what other purpose is there to be human other than to be connecting with other people and with the environment? You know, like, a life without connection is a life that's a little bit lost and missing something, you know, and that connection can come in many ways, you know, different emotions. Doesn't always have to be happy, you know, feelings, but that connection is what makes it important to be engaged.
Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah. And sometimes, you know, like having this interview is great because it's really hard to articulate. Cause I think it's such a sort of abstract thing when you say, like, our mandate is environmental protection through community connection. But at the same time, it's like those practical connections are real. They are real. They are tangible. You feel them. You know when they resonate within you. You know when you need to go towards them. Like, you know, you here at CFUV with your colleagues, like, you know when you've got something good, right? Like, you just get to, like, move towards it and keep being enlightened by it, really, right?
So lastly, we're just at the end of our time. If people want to find out more or get tickets and find out more information.
So as I said at the beginning, this is a free all-ages festival. So the gates are open from 12, well, pretty much before 12 people will be there, but from noon to 6:30 on Saturday, April 26th. There are ticketed events during that day and also Friday evening, the 25th. And our website is www.creativelyunitedfortheplanet.org. You can get tickets online there and also at Lyle's Place for the ticketed events indoors. But otherwise, come and join us. Everyone is welcome, and it's going to be an incredible weekend.
Yeah.
And it's going to be sunny too.
Great. Okay, that's awesome. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks for having us,
Jen.
That's great. Thank you.
So that was Sally Ross from Creatively United for NGO, who are putting on the Creatively United for the Planet Festival. That's coming up this weekend. You can check out their website at www.creativelyunitedfortheplanet.org. They also have a Facebook page that you can check out with all of their information on it. So take a look at that. Up next, we have an interview from a book antiquitarian. So we're going to listen to that.
Greetings and salutations. This is Samantha Rubin, and I am reporting for CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Today, I am absolutely delighted to be speaking with Daphne Lira. Daphne is an antiquarian bookbinder and a longtime family friend. Welcome, Daphne.
Well, thank you, Samantha.
So I've always been very fascinated by your life. I think you've had an extraordinary life and some wonderful experiences, and I would like to hear more about them today. Would you please share with us about your upbringing, where you grew up? And I know that you then immigrated from the U.S. to England and then on to Australia. So tell us a little bit about your childhood, please, Daphne.
My childhood was a very sunny time. Everything was beautiful in California. But most unfortunately and very sadly, suddenly, when I was about 8 years old, my father died of a terrible heart attack, and my mother was left a very young widow with two little girls to bring up and look after. And my mother had been born in England, and so her thoughts were to leave Los Angeles and to bring us both to England and to continue our lives there. It really was a bit of a shock, but off we went. We traveled across the United States on a train. It took days and days and nights. It was an enormous adventure, and we finally got to New York, where we got on a huge liner a Cunard liner, and it was the Queen Mary, and we traveled cabin class, which is one under first class, across the ocean to Southampton. Now, this enormous voyage was wonderful. It was a marvelous adventure for my sister and me, obviously less so for my mum. But anyway, we were on this enormous liner, and we arrived eventually at Southampton. Southampton was a bit of a revelation. I, with my tiny little suitcase, I was told that I had to take things for children who had suffered the war. And so my little tiny suitcase, I filled with bananas and oranges, if you can believe it. I thought they had never seen an orange in England. And we eventually got to London, and there we settled in for quite a long time.
I know that you're quite a bibliophile, and I consider myself one as well. I've just had a tremendous love for books my whole life, and I'm quite a voracious reader. I recall you telling me one time one of your favorite memories when you were a young girl was with your mother reading books, and you had something called Culture Hour. Could you just share with us what Culture Hour was for you and why it was so special, and perhaps how it influenced you with your love of books?
Culture Hour was one of the things I used to look forward to so very much with my mother and my sister. We would sit together with our mum, and she would say, "Now, girls," very seriously. It was quite amusing, but it was very warm and loving. It was really a special time. And she had two books that she loved to get out and read to us. I think she was very serious about our education. One was called Atoms and Molecules, and the other one was called 1, 2, 3 Infinity, which is all about mathematics, way beyond my comprehension. But ultimately, it was just the joy of being the three of us together and listening to my mother read to us. She read us all the usual stories for children, and it was a blissful moment. I would really recommend any parent to do that for their children, just to sit and read to a child and to open the pages of a book. You enter into a very, very special world. It was wonderful. Yes, I think that did influence me enormously for the rest of my life. I realized that between the covers of a book, there was a whole other world. In fact, any world at all that you wish to enter.
That love of books, it seems like it stayed with you throughout your entire life. And was that something you think that helped to shape your future and entering into the profession of bookbinding? Could you tell us about your introduction into that world? What was your journey into becoming a bookbinder? And why did you choose that career path? How did that come into play?
Well, that came about because I, being new in England, I was sent to a little tiny boarding school, and I was not allowed to speak American. I was not allowed to say okay. So eventually I gained an education in many unusual ways via a convent in Belgium, and later after several trips to Paris and living with a Parisian family. None of this qualified me in any way whatsoever to earn a living, which I had to do. So at some stage when I returned to London, I was given the opportunity to be interviewed for the London College of Printing, where they were teaching a course in hand bookbinding, and that struck such a bell with me. I thought, oh, I adore books. I want to know how to bind them. Little did I know how very difficult it is to learn such a skill. So they accepted me, fortunately, and I began my course in London, and almost from the very first day, I somehow knew, this is for me, this will be my spot in life. It was like a flash of lightning. It was just wonderful. I loved the smell of the glue. I loved the look of the tools, the workbenches, all the people, the bustle, and the intensity of it. It's very, very intense. So off I went to the London College of Printing and studied there and worked as much with every ounce of energy that I could put into it. And I just loved it. It was my spot.
At that time, were there many women in that particular field? If you can think back to your classmates, were most of them men?
They were not mostly men, but all the teachers were men. And there were a number of women who had had very wonderful careers, and they somehow decided to have a change in their life, and they'd come to bookbinding. And the men teachers were very seriously discouraging of the women. They kept saying things like, oh, women don't do bookbinding. They only do the sewing, and they only do the preparation, but they don't do the really difficult part. Well, that was the challenge that we needed, because myself and two other women joined forces in the face of all the negativism, and we just went forward, and we passed all our examinations, did all the work with lots of energy and enthusiasm, And eventually, at the end of the course, we actually started up our very first book bindery. It was madly exciting. It really was exciting. All the equipment. And to be in the center of London, in Clerkenwell, which is a very, very ancient part of the city of London. We were fortunate because we set up the workshop very nicely, and we had an enormous window, really huge window, that looked out onto the street, and passers-by would peer in at us as we worked away. And one day, a very interesting man came along and said he has a beautiful collection of books that need work on. Could we work for him? And that was the door we needed. We rushed in and we said, yes, yes, we were very new, newly out of college. But he was a diamond dealer and he had a love, a passion for books. He had a huge collection. And it was mainly Hebraica, which are the Jewish books. And they needed a lot of care and attention. And it was he who handed us our very first opportunity. And I will never, never forget that man. He would come and sit in our workshop because he simply wanted to look at us working on his books. It was really wonderful. And we went on from there, from strength to strength. And two out of the three are still working, and the third is in South Africa living her life.
How fascinating that the gentleman came in to give you the books for restoration. It seems that perhaps some people might have a lot of attachment to books, especially if they're prized family possessions. Were there any stories that you can remember in your years of bookbinding that people had some very sentimental value attached to books and they came in and asked for you to restore perhaps some family heirlooms or maybe historical texts, things like that?
Yes, I have worked on all kinds of things. So, strictly speaking, I'm a hand bookbinder rather than a trade bookbinder. I work. Every single book was a one-off. One very, very touching story that I recall vividly. A man came into the workshop one day. By this time, I had moved to Sydney, Australia, and he brought in a book. He had telephoned me, made an appointment, came into the workshop, and out of his pocket, he took quite a small book. It was rather curved in shape, and it had a black leather cover, and all the corners were no longer right angles. They were all rounded, and it was almost like a very, very old flip book. And he opened it. He put it down on the desk in front of me, and it more or less fell apart. And I said to this chap, "What's the story of this book?" Because it was obvious to me that it had been held in one particular position for years. Well, it turns out that his father, the man's father, had been in the Second World War, and it was his diary as a soldier in the Second World War, and he had carried it in his pocket for 4, 5, 6 years, and every day he wrote a note. And then he had news that his wife had given birth to a boy, and he wrote in this tiny little book a note to my son who was born, and he puts all the dates and everything. And thereafter, it's as though in his diary he is speaking to his newborn son. And here was the son, grown-up man, age maybe 50, 60 years old, bringing me this beautiful diary. He never met his father. His father died in the war. It was the most touching thing you can't imagine because of the shape of the book and how it had been held close to the father's body all those years. And finally, somehow, the son had received this and could read the words that his father had written to him. It was truly moving. So that was one thing that I will never forget. It was quite beautiful. And I was always in a very privileged position because every single person who brought in a book for me to work on, they had some attachment to that particular book for whatever reason. And of course, it was my great pleasure to ask questions and to find out, and then thereafter to explain to the owner exactly the work that had to be done and how the book would look at the end of my work. Because after all, each client was investing in me the most enormous amount of trust because they were giving me their precious, precious book, whatever it may be. Very often it's a cookery book or it's a family Bible and all kinds of things. It's really quite unimaginable. Very, very interesting. If you like people, it's a lovely thing to do because you have the marvelous opportunity to hear their story and the story of the book. But I began to work on earlier and earlier books. My name was given to the rare book collection and special collections of Sydney University. And so I began to work on really early stuff, sort of 15th, 16th century books. And that opened all kinds of doors because it involved a lot of study of the techniques of that time. And of course, these were not printed books. These were long before printing. These were manuscripts written on vellum, parchment. Wonderful, wonderful things. Oh, it was thrilling. It was awe-inspiring. And I adored that. I mean, that is really where I wanted to be. And I felt myself to be so fortunate that I had these opportunities to work on these wonderful things. Some were bound with wooden covers, if you can imagine, the wood from 300-400 years ago, and the pages made of vellum with the ink still on it and the beautiful colors. Oh, it was just a thrilling, thrilling time. I think that I found exactly the work in my life that suited me because I always had this sense of connection with the people who created the books all those hundreds of years ago. So my work spanned from very early work to very contemporary stuff as well. And I was very lucky, I think.
How marvelous when I think about also the resonance that has been built up over time, the people who initially crafted the book and initially bound it, to everyone who has touched the book over a period of years. And perhaps if it were bound again, the person who did that, the family who held the book, who read it, and then being passed down from generation to generation, or if it were a historical text passed from library to library. So each person who has touched and read that book, all of the resonance that's built up, what an amazing thing to feel that. I think it's palpable when you're touching a tome. So I wanted to ask, because you mentioned that this was in Sydney, Australia, that these events were taking place in the bindery. How did it come to pass that you immigrated to Australia? What was an opportunity that presented itself to you when you were in England to enable you to immigrate to Australia?
Well, that's a whole other bit of my life. I was working away with my two colleagues in London very happily when suddenly a man came into the workshop more or less out of the blue, and I had visited Australia, and this chap came in and he said, "Oh, I hear that you've been to Australia. I understand there's a bookbindery for sale in Australia. How about coming to live in Australia?" I thought, how about coming to Australia? I mean, that's the other end of the world. And the seed was planted. I thought, well, maybe, at that time I was a single mum, I thought maybe this will be an opportunity for myself and my daughter to have a new life in a bright, sunny place. And maybe this is a chance to have a new lease of life. And so after almost 2 years of going through immigration and all of that, I eventually went to Australia and I met the two women who owned the business that I eventually bought. I think they must have thought as I walked through the door of their workshop, "Oh, here's somebody who really understands what we've been doing in this business." Now, the business was at that time 100 years old, and I walked in the door and I thought, "Oh, this is for me. This is the place." And so I kind of got all my money together, made them an offer. The two sisters were the granddaughters of the founder of that business. And I think they liked me. I certainly liked them enormously. And I more or less understood exactly what their business was all about, because the workshop had been hand-built just about nearly 70 years prior. So it had a real Dickensian feel to it. And it was in a very good position in the center of the city of Sydney. And as luck would have it, they agreed to sell it to me at a mutually okay price. And I plunged in and I just worked away for the next 27 years without stopping, hardly taking a breath. And then I did stop, luckily. The business still exists, although I'm working virtually very little these days. It's very intense work and very hard work, so I've slowed right down at the moment, which is a nice feeling, I have to say. It feels really good.
I'm quite fascinated to hear about what a day in the life of an antiquarian bookbinder would be. I've never met an antiquarian bookbinder before. You're the first one. And so I'm quite fascinated about all of the accoutrement that you would have in your atelier. What kind of things does a bookbinder use? What instruments do you have? And what would just a typical day be like?
Well, a typical day, for me anyway, starts at about 8:30 in the morning, and really it should start probably about 7 a.m., but I could never quite manage that. I would be at my workbench at 8:30 and would just simply work through the entire day till about 6 o'clock in the afternoon. I would stop for a little bit at lunchtime and then start all over again the following day. I did that probably 5.5 days a week. The work is very, very intense, as I think I've mentioned before. Every book is individual, and so each book has its own requirements. So one starts first thing in the morning with something that is not complex, something that is fairly straightforward, and one moves through all the different stages until one gets to the stage where the gold leaf has to be put on the spine and the gold lettering or the gold tooling has to be put on the spine. Now, that is intensely difficult. So all the gold tooling, maybe, let us say, 3, 4, 5, or 6 books would be brought, repaired up to that stage. And then when you have maybe between 4 or 6 books that need to be gold tooled, one will spend an entire day just doing the gold tooling with a gold leaf. And those tools are very, very beautiful brass tools which have to be heated and impressed on the spines so that the gold will stick to the leather. It's a little bit difficult to describe in words, but there is a YouTube snippet. I mean, it's only about 3 minutes long. It's on the YouTube. If you look up Daphne Lira bookbinder, you will see me placing gold on a book that I've worked on. You'll get a much clearer idea of exactly what part of the procedure. A day will often be interrupted by more people coming with books, and therefore I would break off my work, and then I would speak with the client and look at their books. And also, there was sometimes it was required to wash paper and repair paper and create an entirely new book for, let's say, a visitor's book for a special occasion. Or I did once an enormous, truly gigantic book for the Art Gallery of New South Wales, and that was going to be a special book for the Art Gallery. That's probably a little bit of what one does in one day.
Do you have a website? If you could tell us what the address is of your website and if there are any projects that you're working on at the moment. I know you said that you've slowed down, but maybe you could just tell us briefly about that.
I do have a website. It's a fairly straightforward website, and it's at D.S. Murray. You spell it MURRAY.com. If anybody would be interested, have a look at that, because it will show quite a lot of different things. It's a fairly new website, so it isn't very sophisticated, but it does give one a fairly good idea of what's what. What am I working on at the moment? Well, the past year I have been working on getting together a complete inventory of every single item that I have of this 100-year-old business, and that has been absolutely enormous. So we're still working on that, but actual books at the moment, I'm not working on a particular book. I'm enjoying myself in Victoria and loving the beauty of this wonderful island.
Would you like to give a final message to any women out there who might be contemplating a career or life change, as you did at one point when you took the extraordinary journey to go from England to Australia to become a bookbinder in another country? Is there any last inspiring words that you'd like to share?
Well, I'd like to take the opportunity, actually, to say to any woman who may, like me, be a single mum, there are many moments in one's life where it just seems rather confusing as to how to move forward. And it's really a question of being very careful before you leap. One has to look before one leaps, but there is an element of risk in all these sorts of decisions. But I do feel that there are many, many opportunities. If something speaks to you, as books did to me, have a go. Just simply go for it and keep yourself safe and always keep your friends around you and everything will be all right, provided you have that inner voice that says, this is for me, because it will work out. I mean, with a lot of hard work, obviously. None of this is easy. It doesn't just fall into one's lap, although it might sound as though it does. It doesn't actually. Yeah, I would say take the risk. Just go for it and you'll see what will eventuate, because it's quite fascinating, the journey. It really, really is.
One of my favorite quotes that I have heard over the years is, sometimes your only available transportation is a leap of faith. So on that note, I would like to say thank you so very much, Daphne. It was an absolute pleasure to speak with you. What a delight to hear about your fascinating life and all of the experiences that you've had with the books and bookbinding over the years. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Samantha. It's been a real pleasure.